Episode 100. Feels weird to say that. Episode 100. Episode 100. We thought a lot about what we should do for this episode. After all, it's a pretty significant milestone. A clip show? Too self-referential. A celebrity interview? Too self-indulgent. Just let it go, unacknowledged? Too self-effacing. When Jim Knotts asked me in late 2019 whether I could help VVMF launch a podcast, I think I might have laughed. I was a writer, not a podcaster. But I was a podcast junkie, and I thought maybe I could help VVMF develop the framework for a podcast. The editorial philosophy, some production guidelines, a template for episodes, and maybe the broad strokes of a promotional strategy. So that's what I offered Jim. I would work with his team to architect it, design it, build it, and launch it. And then, like any good consultant, I'd ride off into the sunset. And Jim said, "That's an interesting proposal, but I was thinking you could host it and produce it." And I laughed some more, and then I said, "Well, maybe I can produce and host a handful of episodes to get you started, but after that, you'll need to bring in somebody with actual production skills. That's a profession," I said, "and it isn't mine." That was 100 episodes ago. So why am I still here? It's pretty simple, really. I just love stories. And the stories that have been shared with me by Vietnam veterans and the people who love them have enhanced my life. I cannot scream thank you loudly enough to them for sharing and to you for listening. You're the reason we're able to keep doing this. You're the reason that people continue to share their stories. You make them feel heard. You're good medicine. So, in honor of our 100th episode, I just wanted to acknowledge that, to say thank you, and then to get back to work. Stick around. From the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund, founders of The Wall, this is Echoes of the Vietnam War. I'm your host, Michael Crone, bringing you stories of service, sacrifice, and healing from people who still feel the impact of that conflict more than 50 years later. Episode 100, Born from War. Right after this. Let's talk about The Wall for a minute. It is widely considered to be the memorial that changed memorials forever. Its design invites a level of engagement, of introspection, of reverence that no fountain, no statue of a cannon or a man on a horse could ever match. The volunteers who work there often talk about wall magic, that unexpected, often spiritual connection or discovery that happens when you visit the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. It's one of the reasons why the wall's design has inspired so many other memorials around the world. Of course, there is one little problem with the wall's design. 140 panels of polished black granite aren't exactly portable. So, unless you can get yourself to Washington, D.C., how are you supposed to experience wall magic for yourself? Well, guess what? We already thought of that. In 1996, VVMF unveiled an exact replica of the wall that could be packed into an 18-wheeler and hauled to cities and towns all across America. Since then, the wall that heals has been displayed in more than 800 communities throughout the nation, spreading the healing legacy of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial to millions of visitors. Sure, there are other versions of the wall that travel around the country, but the wall that heals is the only one that is an exact replica of the one in Washington, created and maintained by the same organization that built the wall in the first place. And not only that, the wall that heals is accompanied and curated by VVMF employees who work with host communities to ensure that the experience is as close as possible to the real thing. And that includes wall magic. But you don't have to take my word for it. You can check out episode 15 of this podcast to learn what happens to people's hearts when this traveling exhibit rolls into a real-life American community. The Wall That Heals and the Mobile Education Center that travels with it will be in Buckner, Missouri, July 31 through August 3, and Nevada, Iowa, August 7 through 10. To see the rest of this year's tour schedule and to learn how you can bring the Wall That Heals to your town, visit vvmf.org.
Patrick Naughton. I teach at the Command and General Staff College.
Patrick Naughton is a lieutenant colonel in the Army and a distinguished military historian. He joined me via Zoom from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
I teach young captains and majors basically how to become field grade senior officers.
And how long have you been in the Army?
Joined in 1996, so 28 years. Got enlisted time, about almost 10 years of enlisted time, and then switched over to officer. Been doing that ever since.
So do you think you'll stick with it, or is it just a phase that you're going through?
We actually just submitted our retirement packet, so should be retiring next summer.
Oh, no kidding. That's so exciting.
Yeah, very exciting.
Patrick is a combat veteran of the Global War on Terror. His father is a combat veteran of the Vietnam War. Recently, Patrick published his first book, Born from War: A Soldier's Quest to Understand Vietnam, Iraq, and the Generational Impact of Conflict. In it, Patrick compares his father's experience in Vietnam to his own experience in Iraq.
My father is a Vietnam veteran. He served with the 82nd Airborne as an infantry officer, and he was also an Arvin advisor to the South Vietnamese Army. He never talked about Vietnam, really, or the war, but I knew that he had served there. But the book is basically, several years ago, we discovered this big trove of letters that he wrote home to the family of his year at Vietnam, as well as a diary that he kept. So I took all of that, and I basically traced his year of war that he did in Vietnam, and then overlaid that onto my year of war that I did in Iraq. And so it's a back and forth. It talks about his service in Vietnam, that time period that he grew up in with all the young men that were dying in his neighborhood in Vietnam. And then he eventually found himself in Vietnam, how he served there, and then how that his service then influenced me to then join and do my own time in Iraq. So I look at it from a very human level of both of our service on that ground tactical level, all the way to the operational strategic things that were happening in both wars, and also that legacy of Vietnam and how that then influenced how we operated in Iraq and Afghanistan. But at its core, the book is really about the legacy of Vietnam and the influence that it had, not only on my family, but on me personally. And then on that bigger level, that influence that it's had on the country in all aspects, including how the media covers conflict, how foreign policymakers discuss and determine policies that then get us into conflict.
So you said that your dad never talked about his year in Vietnam. And tell me the dates.
Yeah, so he was there at a really interesting time because he was there from April 1969 to about April 1970. He was there when that switch happened from pacification to Vietnamization. His first tour, his 6 months of his tour, was with the 82nd Airborne, doing pacification around Saigon. And then he switched to the Arvin and was the lead for Vietnamization for the second 6 months of his tour. And it literally happened at the exact same time that it happened at that strategic level, and that was December 1969. So really critical turning point of the war, and he was there for that, both doing it at that tactical level, connecting to when it happened strategically. So really interesting time to study that conflict and how it then influenced me to join the Army.
Sure. Now, you said he never really talked about his year or his 13 months in Vietnam, and yet you also said that it had a profound impact on you. So how did that impact manifest itself if it wasn't through stories that your dad told?
As a kid, you like to sneak around through your parents' closets and look through their drawers when they're not around. And so when I did that, I would find little pieces of uniform, like the combat infantryman badge, Bronze Star, crumbling, those old green notebooks for the awards and stuff, that they were all crumbling and yellowing. So I would find things like that. And that just really had an impact on me because I really didn't know what it was, but I knew that it was something special or something important that happened in my dad's life. And then as a young man, you watch in the 80s, especially, you watch all these corny Vietnam movies, Rambo, Missing in Action, and all these ridiculous movies. And that has an influence on you as well. And then you think that's your dad. My dad was Rambo in Vietnam. And then one of the earliest memories I have of something that he said about Vietnam was we were sitting around the dinner tables, my sister and I. She's 2 years younger than me and my dad. And then just out of nowhere, he says, one time in Vietnam, I saw a man step on a landmine and he disintegrated in front of me. And then he just went back to eating. And my sister and I, we were probably 11, 12. And we're just like, what just happened? What was that? And so there was little things like that just came out of nowhere that happened every couple of years. So all of that combined really had an influence on me. And then when I was a young man, we were running around the woods, reliving Rambo, Missing in Action, or what we thought was Vietnam. I think that's a lesson for all veterans, is that even if we don't talk about our service, we really have no idea what an impact it has on our loved ones.
Did you have any sense growing up that your father was processing maybe some trauma? Did you ever think that, or was it fairly normal?
As children of combat veterans, I think there's a normal for us that is probably not normal for other children. None of that stuff even registered until I became an adult, served in my own conflict and served in the Army, not even knowing what that even was, PTSD. Even that's really, you know, it's been around since the beginning of conflict, but it's only recently in our wars, the global war on terrorism, that stuff has really come to the forefront and is comfortable to talk about in open settings. For my dad's generation, it was definitely something that was not okay to talk about with anybody in an open setting. So it was just the normal. It wasn't something that was weird or I thought was, oh man, you need help or anything like that. And my dad is a great man. He's a great father. He never drank alcohol, never beat us, never yelled at us, any of those types of things. So there was no signaling to me that he was trying to process any of that trauma. What's really interesting is that as a young man, I really didn't feel comfortable talking to him about it, asking him about his Vietnam experience. So it wasn't something that we did. But once I, you know, had so many years under my belt in the Army and then had been in Iraq and writing this book, then I was able to really ask him questions. And I think maybe he felt more comfortable opening up to me, and he really did. Through his letters and his diary, I was actually able to track down a number of people that he served with, both the 82nd and as an ARVN advisor. And I interviewed them for the book. So I got a whole different perspective from them of my dad 50 years ago. So all of that was really eye-opening and really gave me an opportunity to know my father, this Vietnam veteran, who I think many people have not had the chance to do.
Did your father stay in the Army after he came home?
No, he did 1 year at Fort Benning. He was running ranges and he said, this is horrible. He volunteered for Vietnam. And so he did that year in Vietnam, came back for several more months in Fort Benning, and that was it. So he just did about 2 years in the Army and that was it. And just from those 2 years, you know, still had an enormous influence on me growing up.
And what would you say his rank was?
So he was a first lieutenant when he got out.
Was he commissioned while he was in Vietnam?
So he went to ROTC at the University of Hawaii. He graduated in 1966 and then got a deferment to get his master's degree. So he did that. And then, of course, the big green machine came for their due. And that was in 1969 when they said, all right, your deferment's over. You're coming back into the Army.
Yeah. And you said he was at Fort Benning and he was so unhappy with the work that he volunteered to go to Vietnam. Was he single when he made that decision?
So he had recently broken up with a girlfriend. So that was probably something else that kind of motivated him. A young man, you're like, oh, sure. I'm going to go to war.
I'll show her.
Yeah, exactly.
After a short break, Patrick talks about his own path to the military and what combat taught him about his father. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Ann Margaret. I went to Vietnam to entertain the troops in 1966 and 1968. My guys, my gentlemen, if you lived through the Vietnam War era, you know the impact that the war had. But today, we are in danger of history being lost. Current generations know very little about the war or the people who served. As more of our Vietnam vets pass away each day, their stories are being lost to history. Together, we can change that. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund is the organization that built the wall. It works to ensure that future generations will understand the war's impact. Let's help keep the promise that the wall was built on. Never forget. Visit vvmf.org to find out how you can get involved.
Napoleon Bonaparte famously said that an army travels on its stomach. So, here at Echoes, we'd love to dedicate an episode to the mess cooks who served in the Vietnam War. If you or someone you know helped keep those fighting bellies full, we'd sure love to hear those stories. Send us a note at echoes@vvmf.org. And now, back to my conversation with Patrick Naughton.
What was your path to the military, and how did you know that was the right path for you?
Yeah, as a kid, again, that influence, we were always playing G.I. Joes and running around in the woods and facing our own Viet Cong in the woods of Hawaii. And so it was always there that I felt that I was going to join the Army. My father had been in the Army. Our family can trace its service back all the way to the American Revolution of having somebody in the Army serving in each one of those conflicts. So it was kind of like an unwritten rule that I was going to go to the Army. And then I got into a lot of trouble as a teenager, and I was in high school and I'm making trouble in class, and the teacher started yelling at me, "What are you going to do with your life?" And I was like, "Fuck you, I'm going to join the Army." And so she was like, "Okay, hold on." And so she got on the phone, because there was a classroom in the back of the phone then for troublemakers. And she said, "Oh, Patrick, here's a phone call for you." And it was a recruiter. And the recruiter was like, "Meet me at the flagpole outside of school at the end of the day." I was 17 at the time. And so my dad signed the delayed entry program and joined the Army. And as soon as I turned 18 and graduated high school, I was gone like the next month. And I went into the infantry at Fort Benning, followed my dad's footsteps, but as an enlisted soldier.
Any regrets early on, or were you pretty sure this was the way you wanted to go?
No, once I got to the Army and was at Fort Benning, and it was tough, obviously. And I had been this kind of young street kid who was always in trouble running the streets late at night. The Army was the structure that I needed. It really, in my opinion, saved my life. Had I not gone that route, I probably would have ended up in jail or worse. Once I got there, and I'm treading the same ground that my father did as he was training for Vietnam, once I kind of realized that, that was a huge sense of self-pride for me that I was following literally in his footsteps.
Yeah, that's amazing. What's so amazing about it to me, and maybe you could comment on this, is that he was only in the Army for 2 years, which means he had a long career doing something other than the Army.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that was, but that didn't interest you.
Yeah, so he was a PhD basically in geography and taught at the University of Hawaii.
So you wouldn't have felt the same sense of pride if you had been a doctoral candidate in the same place where your father was.
No, I probably wouldn't. But as a young man, you grow up knowing that your dad was a Vietnam veteran, and then you grow up on these stupid movies that kind of indoctrinate you into, to be a man, you have to be in the Army.
And how long were you in the Army before you were sent to Iraq?
I joined in 1996, and September 11th didn't happen until, obviously, 2001, so I'd already been in the Army that long. And what's interesting about my time in the infantry, so when my father, Vietnam, the infantry was the ones who were bearing the brunt of that conflict, obviously. Whereas when I was in the infantry, at that point, we had gone through the first Gulf War, we'd gone through what I call Tomahawk diplomacy, where everything was the air war in Bosnia and other places in Iraq and so on. And so the day of the infantry was over. It was decided by people a lot smarter than me that we didn't need infantry anymore. So at that time, I was like in a 12-man platoon. We barely had ammo to train with. And then September 11th happened, and all of a sudden it was, oh my God, we need the infantry again. And we had to plus up the infantry all over again. So it was a real interesting time to see that change, where we thought that we could extend our influence around the world without having boots on the ground, which we had to learn the hard way again. That's just not true.
And so when you left to go fight in Iraq, how much did you know about your father's experience in Vietnam?
Not much. Still not a lot.
He didn't sit you down and say, "Hey, you're going off to war. Let me share with you what I learned." Nothing like that.
No, not really. He just took it in stride, obviously. Probably bothered him a little bit. But no, it wasn't until 3.5 years ago when I started writing this book that I really started talking to him in great detail about it. And then talking with all the other Vietnam veterans that he had served with.
Yeah, so take me to that moment, the moment that you discovered the diaries. Walk me through the process that led to the writing of this book. And particularly, I'm interested in how those early conversations with your father went. Because at that point, you're both combat veterans.
We are, yep. Yeah, so as a kid, I remember running across letters in a diary. I remember that, but It wasn't until my dad wanted to move into a smaller place and we were helping him move and we're finding all this stuff. And it's, whoa, look at all this. It's huge. I'm talking like a box full of, got to be 300 something letters in there. And then that diary. So it was huge to discover all that. And then I didn't want to ask for it outright. At that time, I had already written, I think, about 12 articles in various publications. So it was becoming a huge hobby of mine. And I wanted to write a book. And so once we found all that stuff, that was a book idea that came up in my head of, oh man, we could do like a compare and contrast of these two conflicts and the generational influence. And I was still hesitant to ask him like, hey, can I look through all this stuff? And when I finally got up the courage enough to ask him, I was surprised that he was like, oh yeah, absolutely. Here you go. And then once I started reading through the material and then I had questions, started out slow at first. Hey, could you expand on this that you wrote about? And he would give a little bit. And then, so we just went from there. And then by the end, there was nothing that was off limits. And the conversation was, he was very open about his year in Vietnam and all the stuff that he went through. And then anything that was still missing that maybe he didn't remember, I was able to reach out to people that he had served with, finding them through social media. And then I was able to fill in any gaps. Plus, I was able to reconnect all of them who had not talked to each other in over 4 decades or so. By the end, I was very shocked by how open he had become when all my life he did not want to talk about it at all.
It sounds like he wasn't getting together with buddies from the Army, nothing like that.
He never even wore a hat that said Vietnam veteran or any bumper stickers or anything like that. The only time I remember about him even doing anything related to Vietnam was when every so often somebody would pop up that he had served with and they would pop up visiting Hawaii on vacation. And they would go off in the corner and whisper to each other for several hours. And then also the traveling Vietnam wall that came to Hawaii. And I remember that as a kid. And I remember holding his hand and looking up at him as tears were coming down his eyes as he was standing there in front of the wall. And as a kid, again, not even knowing what the heck was going on. And the other people at the wall were a lot of grizzled looking old bikers. There was a big biker gang in Hawaii called Ko'opuna. And a lot of them were Vietnam veterans. So a lot of them were there. And my dad really stuck out because he's in business attire with short cropped hair. He's a teacher. He looks very professional. And he's standing there surrounded by all these bikers and they're all hugging and holding on each other. And he was welcome in that group. In any other scenario, he would not be welcome in that group. They would have been like, what are you doing here, Poindexter? Get out of here. All of that as a kid, not understanding any of that until I became an adult. And then, of course, served in the Army in my own war and then being able to talk to him more about it later.
When you were talking to him about his experience in Vietnam, what was the most interesting or surprising thing that he said about that second 6 months about being an advisor, an ARVN advisor during Vietnamization?
Yeah, he was very tactical level. He was a lieutenant advising a battalion. So they were taking it to the enemy, right? Day in and day out. He saw way more combat with the South Vietnamese Army than he saw with the 82nd Airborne. He has nothing but praise for the South Vietnamese Army. So the common rap that they get that they were all horrible fighters and the saying that I can sell you an ARVN rifle, never fired, only dropped once. Completely turned that on his head. He thought they were real tigers on the battlefield. But the really interesting comment that comes from, so Major Richard Keller at the time was my dad's team leader for that advisory team. He actually retired as a lieutenant general, and I interviewed him for the book. Really great guy. But he talks about Melvin Lard, the SecDef, coming to visit him, Trung Lap, where they were serving, doing this Vietnamization. And Lard is telling him all these great things that he's heard about that his team has been doing. And General Keller, it was just shocked. And he's, what are you reading? That's not what I'm submitting in my reports. That's not what's happening here at the ground level at all. Like, what is happening with the report that I'm submitting by the time it gets from when I submit it to my hire till it gets to you? So that was a really interesting thing. And then even he's like, Vietnamization, he had heard of it. He's a team leader managing this entire operational area. And he had to go figure out what the heck it was. And there's an interesting quote that I include in the book about Abrams. He's now in charge at that time. It's not Westmoreland. And the Abram Chronicles, they've got all the minutes from all his meetings and so on. And he basically rattles his staff in a staff meeting. And he's like, hey, what the hell is this Vietnamization thing I keep hearing about? Can somebody go please find out from the White House what the hell that thing is? And this is like a month into Vietnamization already. So that was really interesting to me, is that where Vietnamization was born at those strategic levels. And then what the concept they had out on it and how it took forever to filter down to that tactical level. But by then, Vietnamization was the buzzword. It was on that fast track, on that train going down the tracks. Everybody else just had to catch up to it at that point. So I think that was probably the most interesting thing I read about that time period.
When you look at your combat experience and your father's combat experience in parallel. I'm assuming that you look at it at various altitudes, right? Can you help me understand what those altitudes are and then give me an example of each?
Yeah, when I went to Iraq, I was serving in a strategic headquarters. So we were really doing strategic operational planning. I was traveling around the country. At that point, it was like my father's experience that we were on the tail end of the conflict. We were trying to figure out a way to disengage ourselves from this past 10 years of war that we were just in. The combat that my dad saw is very different than the combat that I saw. And he was boots in the chest, bayonets to the face type of combat with the 82nd Airborne, where mine was more removed with IEDs, indirect fire, mortar, rockets, things like that. The ugliness of what the Vietnam veterans experienced when they were fighting and the sheer scale of casualties, 58,000 plus casualties, you're talking 200 something a day in some cases. That's just something that we could not fathom.
Yeah. One of the things that's really interesting to me is the difference in the geopolitical climate and how that manifested itself in his experience and your experience. He was in Vietnam during the Cold War. You were in Iraq after the end of the Cold War. How did that show up for you and for him?
Yeah, writing the book, it's so hard to look back at Vietnam and try to understand, like, why were we in Vietnam? Like, when you look at it today through a modern lens, it just doesn't make sense. But when you look at it through back then and that threat of communism that was very real and very visceral for everybody in that generation, it was a very real thing, that domino effect. The communists were slowly toppling regimes around the world and swaying people to their way of life. And their whole point was to then topple the West way of life, capitalism, etc. And so when you look at it through that context, then Vietnam makes sense. Then Korea makes sense. Then some of the other proxy banana wars and so on that we got involved in indirectly and directly, they make sense. So when you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, we look at it now and we ask ourselves, what were we doing in Iraq and Afghanistan? And we question our decisions and we're like, why were we there? What did we achieve? But we forget where we were on September 12th, 2001. We have already forgotten what that felt like, where there was a terrorist underneath every bush, and we thought that we were going to get hit constantly for the next however many decades. And so that threat of terrorism, radical Islam, was so real and so visceral, just like as it was for communism back in the Vietnam era. And we've already forgotten about
this,
that.
This is a really important point, I think, right? Because I certainly remember that time vividly. And with the benefit of hindsight, we look back at September 11, and it's a trio of isolated incidents. But at the time, it didn't feel that way. It felt, wow, this could be the new normal.
And so when you look at it through that context, then, okay, Iraq, Afghanistan makes sense how we got involved there. And so it's very easy looking back in hindsight and making those judgment calls of what the heck were those people thinking when they made those decisions. But you've got to put yourself in their shoes, understand the threat of communism that it had over the world at that time, and then the threat that radical Islam had in those years after September 11th.
Sure.
And then it makes a little more sense.
The larger point is we were responding to something. It didn't come from nothing.
Exactly.
It occurs to me that you're in a unique position because you are a combat veteran from the War on Terror. You probably know more about the Vietnam War than a lot of your peers. For the people who are listening who are part of the Vietnam generation, what is the most important thing that you think they don't know about the War on Terror?
Yeah, I think the most important thing they probably don't know is the legacy of the Vietnam War and the influence that has had on policymakers, both in the military and in our civilian government, has had in probably every foreign policy decision that we have made since the end of Vietnam, to include Iraq, Afghanistan. You look at Iraq and Afghanistan, we put boots on the ground, but there was still this hesitancy to go all in because we didn't want to see another Vietnam. We didn't want to see another 58,000 casualties. We didn't want to see another 200 a day casualties coming home. And all of that is that legacy of Vietnam. And so I would think that they probably don't realize how much an impact that has had on foreign policy decision makers ever since the end of that war.
And what about if I flipped it and I asked you, what's the most important thing about the war in Vietnam that the younger generation doesn't know?
Yeah, I would say people looking at the way our society is structured today don't really realize what an influence Vietnam had. It still reverberates to this day. And I think my generation, especially the foreign policy decision makers who were deciding how we were going to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, made a lot of the same mistakes that had they studied Vietnam probably could have avoided. I did 2 years as a representative from the Army to the Senate, basically called a legislative liaison. So I sat in all types of high-level meetings, got to peek behind the curtain of that interaction between military senior leaders and the political senior leaders and the discussions that they would have. I signed an NDA, so I can't really talk about specifics, but I can say, and to a point that I touched on earlier, is that ghost of Vietnam was present in all of those discussions. It wasn't said outright, but it was always, anytime some type of military option was proposed to whatever problem set that was out there in the world, there was always a hesitation immediately to commit any type of troops. You could tell there was always an influence there. It's always there. It's still going to be there. And now it's even worse as we move forward looking at foreign policy decisions, because now we're going to have the ghost of Vietnam and we're going to have the ghoul of Iraq and Afghanistan. Both of them joined together are now going to be walking the halls of Congress and the Pentagon, influencing any foreign policy decisions that we make in the future.
Now that you and your dad have been down this road together of sharing each other's combat experience, the resulting book, which you said your dad has read several times, he's opened up now about his experience. And I'm assuming that whole experience has been recontextualized for him as a result of all these conversations and this project that you guys have done together. Mm-hmm. Now, is he wearing a Vietnam veteran ball cap? Or
he's not
doing anything, still, going to reunions,
no
anything?
Outward sign. No, he is sharing my book with others that he served with and things like that. But no other outward type of show that he's a Vietnam vet. Mm. Still, he's proud of his service, but it's just not something that he feels that he has to advertise out there.
Yeah,
which is fine.
Yeah,
and you know, I would say last thing I would say to that is anybody who has a Vietnam vet in their family, whether it's a parent or an uncle or an aunt or something, now is the time to get their stories. And you don't necessarily have to write a book like I did, but I would say get out a tape recorder or whatever it is, get on Zoom and talk to them about it, record their stories, because it's going to be really important. We talk about the World War II generation dying off, but really it's Vietnam veteran generation is right behind them. And so I think it's a fascinating conflict that we can learn a lot from as a nation, as a people, and as a military. So I think it's important to capture all those stories. I'm a military historian. My favorite conflict is really the American Civil War. But from writing this book, I'm slowly turning into a Vietnam War historian, kicking and screaming, but the war is so fascinating that it's really sucking me in. And yeah, I would say that's my biggest advice is just capture those stories now. Let's understand the legacy of Vietnam.
Patrick Naughton's book, Born from War, A Soldier's Quest to Understand Vietnam, Iraq, and the Generational Impact of Conflict, is now available as a hardcover or ebook through Amazon, direct from Casemate Publishers, or through a host of other booksellers. We'll be back shortly with more stories of service, sacrifice, and healing. See you then.